Welcome to this first ever episode of the Copywriter's Cupboard podcast, the podcast that helps you become a better writer and creative. Over this short first series of the Copywriter's Cupboard, we'll be having insightful conversations with interesting people, covering topics like sustainability, crisis communications, storytelling, how to be a successful freelancer, and what it's like to do an MA in creative writing. So since this is the first episode, I should probably start by introducing myself. My name is Fergus Dullahan. I'm an Irish guy raised in England. I did my degree in modern languages at Bangor University in Wales. I'm currently a creative director at one of Switzerland's leading creative agencies, Charles Cannon. I've been the agency's lead writer since 2015, and I've been writing professionally since 2009. I do a lot of sustainability writing at the moment, and one of my most recent projects was writing the Nestle sustainability report. I've been living with my wife in Geneva, Switzerland for about 10 years, and I'm also a dad of two amazing kids, the youngest of whom is only just out of nappies. Finally, before I started writing, I was an elite athlete in the sport of judo, so you'll probably notice as the episodes progress that performance is something I'm really interested in uncovering tips for, whether that's for writing or any other area of life. Okay, so now that's out of the way, the embarrassing part, let's open the cupboard. If you are a writer, whether you work freelance, in corporate communications, or in an agency like me, there's a strong likelihood that you have to write about sustainability. So we're going to take the opportunity of today's first episode to deep dive into that topic. Today's guest, Scott Poynton, is a sustainability expert, coach, author, and podcaster. After graduating from the Australian National University and later completing his MSc at the University of Oxford, Scott spent 11 years working as a forester. In 1999, he founded the Tropical Forest Trust, now known as Earthworm. The foundation focuses on making agriculture a more resilient and regenerative industry and has grown to over 250 employees working in 48 countries across 19 commodities. After 17 years of leading Earthworm, Scott handed over the reins and launched a new coaching organization called A Different Way to support people, communities, organizations, and industries through complex and challenging transitions. In 2021, he launched the Pond Foundation to help inspire people and businesses to take climate action. He's also a forest therapy guide, and it was in this context that I first met him. Well, Scott, thank you for taking the time to talk to us. What first drew you to forestry?
Yeah, thanks, Fergus. So I'll try and keep it not too long, but I was very blessed to have listened to a very, very ancient old man on the radio. And his name was Richard St. Barbe Baker. And this was 3 days after my 15th birthday. And it was very bizarre for me to be inside listening to the radio. I don't know how that happened. I think it was meant to be. Up until that stage, I had wanted to be a vet. And really, since I was 10 and 11, I grew up in rural Australia. I was going out with the local vet, friend of my dad's, and he said, "Oh yeah, I'll take Scott, you know, with me." And I had this amazing experience of going out and, you know, putting my hands in cows where they probably shouldn't have been and all sorts of things. And the vet was teaching me. It was marvelous. And I thought, oh yes, I love that. But I have to say, there was always this sort of itch about, yeah, well, if I'm going to be a vet, I'll end up living around here or someone else in Australia, and I'll be operating on cats and dogs, and I'll feel good about that. But I had this itch to do something overseas. And there I was, you know, Sunday afternoon, outside with my dogs. And for some reason, I went inside. Maybe I needed a glass of water, I don't know. And even stranger, the radio was on, because that never happened. And here was this program. And it was starting, it was just starting. And there was this beautiful music and this old man's voice. And this old British forester, St. Barbe Baker, he had a voice like an oak tree, I would say. And he started with this poem. And the radio, the broadcast started with this beautiful music. And I wasn't really into classical music, but just the combination of this beautiful classic music and then this old man talking about, reading this beautiful poem about forests. I'm like, wow, what's this? And it was a 30-minute broadcast, but he had me after about 2 minutes. And he just talked about all of his life traveling the world, trying to inspire people to protect forests and plant trees. I didn't even know that a forester existed as a profession at that stage. But after that broadcast, it was like, right, well, I'm going to follow in his footsteps. And so that was the moment where I said, right, I'm going to be a forester. and my mission will be to work overseas and try and protect particularly tropical forests. It wasn't just tropical forests, it was forests in general, but I had this idea that I'd do something in the tropics.
That's fantastic. What a great story. And I was the same. I didn't know what forestry was until I studied with it. I lived with a guy who was studying forestry at university, and that was a big surprise to me that it was a thing you could do. Mm. But what exactly does forestry entail, and what would the day of a forester look like?
Yeah, well, it's very different to what I ended up doing, I've got to say. I mean, to get into overseas forestry, you've got to work in your own country. You've got to have experience. You can't just walk in, somewhere else, say, oh, I've got a forestry degree, give me a job. Because in all of these countries overseas, they have foresters too. So you've got to bring something of value. And so experience is one of those things. So I was looking at getting a job overseas, and they all said, oh, you've got to work in Australia first, and you then needed a master's. And so I was very lucky. I got a job in forestry in Tasmania after I graduated. And it was a fantastic experience. I went down there, and I would say the job of a forester in Tasmania is probably typical of a job of a forester in most countries. And to my unhappiness now, because the focus is very much on harvesting trees for timber. And one of the things when I listened to St. Barb Baker's broadcast, and I wrote to the ABC radio who broadcasted it about 33 years later, and they still had it and they sent it to me. And I listened to it again. And one of the beautiful things was when he started saying, well, of course, we can't live for 2 minutes without oxygen, and trees give us oxygen. And we can't live without water, and trees are very important in the water cycle. We need foods, we need medicines. And he eventually got to, oh, by the way, we need timber. And it was like seventh on the list. But when you study forestry, timber has primacy. And so it's very much about going into a forest, working out how much wood is available, how much it grows each year, because forestry was the whole idea of sustainability started with forestry. German forestry back in the 1860s and 1870s, there was a very famous forester called Wilhelm Schlick, and he came up with this idea of sustained yield. So work out how much wood the forest puts on each year and don't cut more than that. So he really was like the father of sustainability. It didn't really take off in any way outside of forestry, but it became this mantra. So if you're going to harvest timber, make sure you understand how much timber the forest is growing. So there's a lot of inventory, tree measurements for a typical forester, and then you say, right, we're going to harvest the timber over there, and so you have to go and say, okay, how many big trees are there, small trees, how do we cut them, because the objective is to regenerate it. If you're a forester, it's not about deforestation, it's about how do we regenerate it. So in some forests, clear fell, make a big space, sometimes even burn it, and get the seed on there and way, away it goes, the next generation comes. In other places, you just take a tree here and take a tree there, and the new trees come. So you've got to understand the forest that you're working with. You've got to understand how it regenerates, and then you've got to try and mimic that in your practices. And so this is what we did in Tasmania. We had dry forests, we had very wet forests. There was a lot of controversy in Tasmania because there was a lot of special, very special rainforests. The Wilderness Society was very active there. They got started there. Campaigning against the forestry, Tasmania people, against the forest industry. And I had a lot of sympathy with what they were saying. There wasn't a lot of reserves protecting forests in Tasmania because we're all very focused on keeping the industry going. And so, St. Barb Baker's words about protecting forests, to me, when I look at forestry around the world, he had a much broader vision of what a forester should be about than I think what is practiced today. Mm. Nonetheless, I had an amazing experience in Tasmania working there. And yes, we organised the harvesting of forests. We organised regeneration, and some of it was just natural regeneration. Some of it we burnt these forests, hot burns, clear fell hot burns. I mean, the worst scenario for green groups around the world. Mm. But the forest came back. The regeneration came back very strongly. There's forests there now that are being harvested again, having been harvested initially in the 60s and 70s. So for a sustainable industry, that's great. But I think they could have done more in setting aside some of those representative forest areas.
Yeah.
And in Tasmania, they were special. These were the tallest trees in the world.
Wow.
Taller than the redwoods in California. And in Victoria as well, the tallest tree ever measured was measured at 153 metres. It was a eucalyptus,
wow,
a mountain ash, but it was measured horizontally after they cut it down and they ran a tape over it. So this is the sort of thing that happened. And so a lot of these magnificent giants were just stripped out of the forest and sent to be used for making paper, for example.
Yeah.
So I have some sympathy. You know, if my good mates in Australia say, oh, you know, I don't know what's happened to you, you've lost your way. But I do have to say that I do feel that collectively, not just in Australia, but foresters the world over are just so focused on timber. And so that's the typical day of a forester. Yeah. They do worry about biodiversity. They do worry about these things, but they're usually not even second or third. They're down, you know, timber, jobs, soil protection, and maybe a bit of, yeah, biodiversity. And some foresters would argue that's not the case, but in practice, I think it is.
That's your feeling.
Yeah.
So we'll get on to talk about sustainability and deforestation and reforestation as well a little later. One of the things that the way we met each other was actually through spending time in forests. So this the idea of forest bathing in the Japanese Shinrin-yoku, and all the health benefits that it can bring. And I was wondering if you could talk to the benefits of spending time in forests.
Yeah, they're profound. And I think, you know, I always understood that. I've spent a lot of time in forests. And, you know, when I say that, you know, obviously with work, but outside of work as well. You know, on a weekend, I'd often come up here very blessed to live with forests on our doorstep. And I think I always knew intuitively that this was a good thing for me. And I would bring people on walks in the forest, and particularly mates who are a bit stressed. And, you know, I did a lot of coaching and mentoring. I'm like, let's go for a walk. And it just changed the whole nature of the discussion. People would open up more because they just felt, I think they felt safer here and calmer. But I was also lucky to learn about this whole idea of Shinrin-yoku and forest bathing. And having read up about that, there's been a lot of study of, you know, actual medical science study of the benefits of spending time in forest. And I'm not the best person for remembering all of those, you know, this paper and that paper. I'm a scientific person, but I'm more anecdotal in these things. But it's very, very clear from the science that, and where Shinrin-yoku came from, and it sounds like this ancient Buddhist tradition, but it actually emerged in Japan in the 1980s. And it was a response by the Japanese government to this big leap and big increase of cancers, cardiovascular diseases, stress-related illnesses that were, you know, exploding in the Japanese population. And they put two and two together and said, well, you know, we've all become very sedentary, we've become very technical society, so maybe we need to get people out in the forest again, or at least out in the countryside. And so they came up with this idea of Shinrin-yoku. And the Japanese approach to it is very medical, like go out, sit in the forest, and you'll be better. And come back. And they've done all these measurements. They measure people's blood pressure going in and they measure it coming out. They measure all sorts of...
cortisol and the saliva.
Cortisol, saliva, all of these things. And the results are dramatic. And one of the other aspects is they realise that, you know, and it really is forest bathing. You're not bathing in water, although of course you can in some forests, but you're bathing in the chemicals of the forest. The forests have their own defence systems against pests and diseases, against bacteria, against fungi, against insects who might want to eat their leaves, and they pump out these pheromones and chemicals. And they're literally everywhere. We're sitting here in the forest and we're breathing them in. And what they've learnt is that stimulates our immune system really dramatically, yeah, and particularly our NK cells, natural killer cells, that fight cancer. So here is this concern about, excuse me, all this explosion in cancer, cardiovascular diseases, stress-related illnesses. And the forest sort of ticks all those boxes. And this is what's been shown by medical research, that it really is good for you.
Yeah, and what kind of time do you need to spend in a forest to get these benefits?
Yeah, I think, good question. I would say that it's not just a question of time, it's quality time. I've trained now and I've become a certified forest therapy guide, and it's, for me, it's a lot about slowing down in the forest. Like I used to spend a lot of time in these forests here, walking to the top of the mountain. I think that was good for me. I certainly exercise wise, and I was in the forest a lot, but I wasn't really intentional about it. I was going from A to B, and then from B back to A. And it was a walk, and I was doing that. And you never really slow down, you never really stop in the forest. So the whole idea of the Shinrin Yoku experience in forest therapy is to just slow right down and connect to the forest with all of your senses. When you're going on a hike, you're sort of connecting with your eyes to make sure you don't fall over. But when do you stop and touch something and feel the textures? When do you stop and smell something? When do you, you know, heaven forsake, you know, actually taste something? Put a leaf in your mouth or something like that. It just doesn't happen because you're on a mission. You're trying to get from A to B and back again, and you're usually time constrained. And so I think the value of this forest therapy and Shinrin Yoku forest bathing concept is to just go and chill out. And, you know, honestly, I mean, I would like to say an hour is great, but some people don't have an hour. But if you can have 20 minutes sitting in a forest, if you're absolutely time poor and you can have 20 minutes in a forest and even in a park, because, hey, so many people live in cities, go and do that and it'll have benefit for you. And if you're intentional about it and just go and sit there and admit, you know, your brain will be whirring and all the rest of it, but maybe after 5 or 10 minutes, that'll start to slow down. The longer you can stay, the greater the benefits will come.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because I know obviously with increased urbanization, something like projected to be around 70% of the population eventually living in cities by about 2050. And there's this disconnect between people and nature. But what's extremely interesting for me is the stuff like the blood pressure lowering when you're in a forest. If we were in that natural context more often, would all of our base rates and the benchmarks for those base rates actually be lower than they are currently? You know, and it's just having the time to be in nature is almost something we need to force now, as opposed to just throughout our evolution. I think this is supposed to be one of the first generations where we've spent more time indoors than outdoors.
I'd believe it.
Yeah. And do you have any thoughts about the benefits of those like micro zones like parks, and are they as good as a forest or not quite as good? Or,
well, the extraordinary thing that happened for me during my training as a forest therapy guide was, because of COVID, we had to do it all remotely. And before COVID, you would go on an 8-day training course in a forest with trainers, and then you'd go away and do 6 months of sort of online training. Well, that all got turned on its head because of the pandemic. And so what they were doing was we signed up to our training, we did these Zoom calls, and then they said, right, now you've got to participate in at least 4 walks as part of your training. I'm like, well, how am I going to do that? And they said, no, we're going to do remote walks. We're going to do it on Zoom. I'm like, I'm sitting in my chair. I'm thinking, that's ridiculous. That's not going to work. But then I thought, well, I've got to do it to go through the training. And I like to think that I'm open-minded about these things. So I thought, okay, let's give it a go. And I would have to say to you that it's extraordinary. And here you are on Zoom. And it was the middle of winter, so you couldn't really get outside anyway. So some people did. So we'd have Zoom calls where some people would be in a forest, but they're usually all raining and all the rest of it. And I'm sitting at home, and they would give a series of invitations, and they would do the introduction with the pleasures of presence, where they, you know, encourage you to, even if you're sitting in your house, to smell what's there, touch what's there, taste what's there, listen to what's there, see what's there. So use all of your senses. And after a 2-hour Zoom forest therapy walk, I'm zen. And I came out of the first one going, oh my God, that was incredible.
Even though it was online?
Even though it was completely online. And I was just sitting in my house in Switzerland in the middle of winter on a dark night. And then, you know, did 3 more of those as part of my training. Now, I do think that coming out into the forest overall is better. But I absolutely, I mean, one of the things that I offer, I've offered a few and I've done a few of the virtual walks. I just so prefer doing them in the forest. But I want to do more of the virtual walks, because I fundamentally believe that if we can help people find that calm and find their connection back to nature, the world will be a better place.
Yeah,
I absolutely believe it. And so I've sort of got to get back, I think, to doing more of the virtual walks, because it just opens it up to a bigger audience. I mean, I'm very, you know, you live in Geneva, I live down the road, we're able to do this.
Yeah.
But if you didn't, how would we do that? And I think you can do it through the virtual walk. So I think it's for me, it's been extraordinary. And I participated in 4 virtual walks. I think I've led 2 or 3, And each time I come away thinking that was quite extraordinary. How did that work?
Yeah, that's really interesting. So what do you feel? I want to cover a couple of bits off all at once. First of all, let's go through the what would happen in a standard session. You've mentioned invitations. What are invitations, and how does a Shinrin Yoku session function?
Yeah, so the invitations are exactly that. We use the word deliberately. They are invitations. They're not instructions. So rather than saying, come into the forest, go over and talk to that tree, that's an instruction. With an invitation, it's like we invite you to go out, wander out, and see if there's a being that's calling you or that you feel connected to. And perhaps you'd like to have a conversation with that being. And you just leave it like that. I'll call you back in 15 minutes. It's very open. And so the participant can say, well, okay, I'm going to go and do that. And off they go. And perhaps they decide they're going to have a chat with a rock or a plant or a tree, or there's an insect flying by. People do all sorts of things. Or they might say, actually, you know what, I'm going to go up that hill over there because I'm called to do that. And the thing about the invitations is we always say, do what you're called to do. The idea with forest therapy, Shinrin Yoku, is the guide, the forest is the therapist, the guide opens the door. So my job is not to be the therapist. Thank goodness I'm a forester. What do I know, right? But the forest, the connection to the forest is what we're trying to encourage. And by offering invitations, you just open people to connect to themselves. And what we do, we come into the forest, we give an introduction so that they understand a bit about what's going to happen. We explain about the history of it. We explain about invitations. At the end of each invitation, we do what's called a gather, share and listen, where we invite people to share, and people can share in silence. You know, again, everything is by invitation. Everything is welcome. You're not obliged to speak. Some people come into the forest and they're having something challenging in their life, and this is very much about their relationship with the forest. They don't want to share with the group. That's fine. You can go through an entire forest therapy walk and say nothing, and that is welcome, because it's your experience with the forest. It's not about the guide saying, oh, you know, that person didn't say anything. No. We are here to open the door to the forest and let the people have that experience. So after the introduction, we have a little gather, share and listen. I always like to invite people to say their name so the forest knows who's there. And then we have what's called a standard sequence. And the standard sequence opens always with the same two invitations. And the first one is called Pleasures of Presence. And it's like just a guided meditation where we invite the participants to just, you know, calm right down. Just, you know, you can sit, you can lie down, you can stand. Sometimes I invite people to pick up something from the forest floor that they can hold and feel that sense of connection. And then you go through the senses. So you encourage them to think about their breathing. Well, first you ask them to look around. So they look around, they see their surroundings, they sort of find a connection with it through their eyes. You invite them, if they want to close their eyes, and most people do. And then you invite them just to start feeling their breathing. So they're starting to feel that rhythm of the breath and it's slowing down. And then you invite them to hear the sounds that they can hear. So opening up all the senses. Touch, what are they feeling with their fingers? Maybe they're standing up and they can feel the breeze on their face, for example, but they start to feel that, whereas you just don't normally do that, right, when you're walking through a forest, right, on a hike. You invite them to smell. What can you smell? Taste is a bit more challenging, but, you know, even just tasting the air. What does the air taste like? And so you go through that, and sometimes we use what's called the imaginal sense, where we ask people to imagine, for example, being a bird, or they might imagine they're a tree and their roots going down into the soil, and who do they meet down there? You know, do they meet the other participants down there? So they use their imaginal sense. And we also have this concept of a heart sense. You know, maybe you invite people to put their hand on their heart. What is their heart beating out for into the world? And it just gets them in their body, out of their mind.
Yeah.
And that just slows them right down. And then, you know, eventually I invite them to open their eyes. And it's usually quite a dramatic experience for people where some people say, well, it's like I'm looking at the forest for the first time.
Yeah.
It's like I'm seeing it in 3D, whereas before I wasn't really seeing it. So that's quite a impactful experience. And it does help people slow down. But then you go to the next one, which is always the same, is called What's in Motion. And we invite people to wander out and just notice what's in motion. But we also remind them that if perhaps they're not seeing anything in motion, it's because they're moving too fast.
Yeah.
They're going too fast. And just, you know, invite them to slow down. And if it's a... if sometimes we just do a walk from one place and they fan out and come back. Or sometimes we do, you know, we go along a trail. And we always like to say, look, if you get in front of me, perhaps you're going too fast. Not always. People can go ahead. But, you know, you don't want to constrain them. The whole idea of the forest therapy, like if someone wants to just storm off up the mountain because they're stressed out of their mind, well, probably best they do that.
Mm.
We invite them not to go too far because we want them to come back and be in the group and, you know, there's health and safety issues. But we do encourage people to go slow. And usually by that stage, I've had walks where people come and you can see they're very stressed. They're wound up. They've had a wicked week at work.
Mm.
Or just a wicked day, and everything's 100 miles an hour, talking like this, and everything like this. And you're like, okay. You can feel they're a bit stressed.
Yeah.
But usually after that second one, they're starting to slow down. And then what we do is we just offer a series of partnership invitations. And depending how long we've got, we might offer one, we might offer two or three. 15 minutes around each where we just... So, for example, I invite you to wander out and explore the forest through your sense of smell.
Yeah.
Very simple invitation. And it just gets people out there and they're picking things up and they're smelling and touching and it's just wonderful. It's beautiful to watch. And then they come back and they share and then we do another invitation. And then at the end, we do what's called a tea ceremony where we like to... Now, usually by that stage, you've done two or three, you've done the first two invitations, then two or three partnership invitations. So far, my experience has been people are quite zen.
Yeah.
They're really chilled out. And then we're just like, okay. And they get into what we call this liminal space between... the sort of tamed world where they've been, you know, in the building and work and all the rest of it, and the wild world. They're not completely in the wild world. You know, they've got their car down on the roadside, you know, they've probably got their phone in their pocket. But somehow they've spent this time in the forest and they've become part of the forest.
Yeah.
And the reality is we actually need them to come back out of that when they go back down into their car and drive home because they may, you know, there's a risk they could have an accident or something. So we like to finish with a tea ceremony. And that just gives people an opportunity to reflect on their experience, to round it out. We like to read a little poem. We have a tea. Sometimes we use tea from the forest. And that's what we call this idea of embodiment, where we bring the forest into our body.
Yep. And is the tea related to the Japanese culture, or is it just something that's easy to do? Or
I think the tea ceremony has come from the Japanese culture, but it doesn't have to be like a Japanese tea, for example.
Yeah.
You know, I often just use herbal tea. Here in the forest, I can snip a few things off the spruce or the fir, and that's very good for you, boosts your immune system. There's all sorts of, depending on where you are in the world, there's all sorts of herbs and things that you can use to make the tea. I started with that, but I'm tending to use a herbal tea now that I bring to the forest because I don't like snipping the leaves off the trees. I sort of feel somehow that's not right. Mm. I don't know, I do have a connection with these trees and I tend to do my walks in two or three places. And each time if I come and I start snipping, I start feeling I'm doing the wrong thing. So I'm bringing the tea in now and it's usually a herbal tea or chamomile tea, something that helps people relax at the end. And then we have a reading. We read a little poem or not so much a story. It has to be reasonably short, but it could be a verse, it could be a song, just a poem, something we found. And that sort of officially concludes the walk.
Yeah.
My experience so far, and it's not always the case, and, you know, I have had guides say, oh, we had this person and they weren't into this at all. And, you know, by the end of it, they got up and stormed off.
Mm.
That's rare. That's very, very rare. And touch wood, I haven't had that yet. I've done 28 walks now. I've had, I don't know, couple of hundred people through my walking experience, and usually by that stage, and I've had people very, very stressed and tense almost to the end, but it's almost finally the forest wins.
Hmm.
And they like, yeah,
it's interesting, you know, because a lot of the people on the walks I've been on with you very quickly start reporting this kind of sense of all the senses working fully again. Mm. In a way that they hadn't realized they weren't before.
That's right.
And yet, so you're kind of like, I think someone said today, like hyper vigilant or hyper aware, and yet not stressed and not anxious. It's just this state of heightened awareness of what's going on around you, but in a very calm, sense. It almost feels like the way you imagine one of the lynxes around here must feel most of the time.
Yeah, hyper aware of what's going on. And I had an experience today with our walk where I felt that, I'd say I felt part of the forest. I was standing there and I was just watching, you know, the sun rays were coming down. You could see the insects going through there. I could see the leaves, very small breeze here today. I could just feel the, I could feel the breeze on my face and I could see the leaves moving in the shadows. And I'm like, I'm part of this. And this is the idea of forest therapy, which is a bit different from Shinrin Yoku. Shinrin Yoku is about more about what you can benefit by being in the forest, whereas the idea of forest therapy is, with the Association of Nature and Forest Therapy, is to make it more a reciprocal relationship. Mm. Like, what can you also give back to the forest? And that can be very practical in the sense that, oh, I found some rubbish, therefore I'm going to take it out. But sometimes when I'm going through on a walk, I sometimes find a branch that's broken off and it's fallen down, but it's sort of hanging and it's pulling down the leaves. And I'm like, okay, I'll just help that branch find its way to the ground. And that somehow relieves the pressure on this poor little branch that's now sort of now free again.
Mm.
And I think just being aware of those things as you walk through the forest, you know, even just saying hello to a tree, it sounds a bit weird, but, you know, this is a forest that I've been in so many times, and even as I walk along, just reaching out and touching the bark of a tree is an acknowledgement.
Yep.
that tree is important, and it's important to me in a relationship, in a relational sense.
Yeah,
you know, it's important. Like as you walk past and you know you see your mate, you know, you shake the hand or you tap them on the shoulder and say, "How are you, buddy?" It's the same thing, and I think that once we've been in the forest in a forest therapy context, that becomes a lot easier, and it becomes practice. I whenever I walk now, I'm often, you know, my hands, I put my hand down, I'm touching grass, I'm touching bushes, and I feel connected to that place so much more deeply.
Yeah, it's very similar to other nature therapies like horticultural therapy, animal therapy, where there is a relationship forms.
Yes.
And a mutually beneficial one. I wanted to go back to that interesting idea about people resistance to it. So that, you know, the first time I came, I was a little worried about what everyone would think about what I was doing. You know, I was very self-conscious of the first exercise, you know. But have you encountered a lot of resistance and how do you deal with it?
I haven't, touch wood. I know other guides who do. I think it's more common when, for example, corporate teams are told, you're going on a forest therapy walk. We've hired this bloke or this person, and they're going to lead you on a forest therapy walk. And straight away, people think, therapy?
Mm.
You know, it's easy if they call it Shinrin Yoku. But what we do is a little bit different from Shinrin Yoku. So I use forest bathing, forest therapy, Shinrin Yoku sort of interchangeably. But as soon as people hear about forest therapy, it's like, well, I don't need therapy.
Yeah.
What's that about? And so it's almost like they've got their back up straight away. And the boss has told them they're going to do it. Or the HR department's going to do it. And I've done some of those walks. I've done corporate walks. Touch wood, thankfully, it's been okay. I've sensed that some people are a little bit more hesitant than others, but I just sort of go into it. And what I've found is that when others see other people diving in and no one's sniggering in the corner and laughing at them, and actually people start saying some really interesting things and some profound things, they start getting into it.
Yeah.
On the individual walks, mostly people come because they want to. They're a bit intrigued, they want to, and they're here because they're open to the experience. So on the individual walks, I haven't encountered anything like that. But I think the key is just to keep going and give people that opportunity. If I always say to people, if it's not working for you, just let me know. If you want to leave the walk, do so. But let me know, because I need to know that, you know, numbers and safety, I need to make sure that you're okay.
Yeah.
So far it hasn't happened. So, yeah, touch wood. Yeah.
Yeah, that's good. So I wanted to go back and look a little bit of your history and your relationship with forests as well, because it was more than just in the capacity of a forester and as a forest bathing, how would you call it, guide?
Yeah.
Yeah, that you functioned in a forest or worked in a forest. So in 1999, you founded the Tropical Forest Trust, which has since become Earthworm.
That's right.
Earthworm Foundation. Mm-hmm. So what is the Tropical Forest Trust? What did it do? What led you to set it up?
Yeah, well, I'll try and not give you the War and Peace version of that, but it was a really fascinating journey. And, you know, I was 15 years and 3 days when I listened to St. Bart Baker and Richard St. Bart Baker, and I decided I was going to follow in his footpath. And it was 20 years later that I set up the TFT. And fascinating journey of, you know, if you had asked me, how is that going to manifest itself? How are you going to follow in his footsteps? I had no idea. Mm. No way would I have ever said, well, I'm going to set up a UK registered charity and go and do these things. I had no idea how it was going to unfold. But I just sort of kept going and found myself in interesting places. I got an opportunity to work in Vietnam on an aid project in the Mekong Delta, which meant I learned Vietnamese, which meant I got to travel a fair bit throughout the country. And as part of that, before that, I also had the good fortune to get a scholarship when I was in Tasmania to study a Master's of Forestry in Oxford. And I met lots of people there. And all of these things came together to start the TFT, really, because at the end of 1995, as I came back from Vietnam, a UK company called B&Q, a big do-it-yourself chain,
yep,
they were importing garden furniture from Vietnam. The wooden garden furniture industry had exploded, particularly in Vietnam, where they, instead of using really expensive teak, they were using tropical hardwood, which was about half the price, but was much more beautiful than plastic furniture.
Yeah.
So European market exploded, and they said, well, we want some of that. And so B&Q were importing this from Vietnam, and they said, well, we would like to get it certified under this international scheme, the FSC. And they talked to a company called SGS, one of the big certification companies.
I know SGS.
Yeah. And what happened was the guy who was running the SGS forestry program had been one of my colleagues when I was studying forestry at Oxford.
Oh, wow.
And he knew that I had been in Vietnam and he needed a technical expert, i.e. someone who was a forester, and better, if possible, someone who spoke the language. And I ticked both boxes. So he contacted me and he said, look, we're doing this assessment in Vietnam. And I'm like, I know a lot of forests in Vietnam and I don't think any of them are close to being certified. Where is this forest? And he said, well, it's Ma Da Forest Enterprise. I'm like, I've been to Ma Da Forest Enterprise. There's no trees there. Mm. And he's like, what do you mean? And I said, well, there are trees, but they're all pretty small. They're acacia and teak plantations. There's a little bit of natural forest, but outside of Ho Chi Minh City, it was one of the forests that had been sprayed by the Americans with Agent Orange, mm-hmm, because the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese Army spent a lot of time in there,
yep,
attacking Ho Chi Minh City, attacking Saigon. So they sprayed it, and the forest never really recovered. And he says, oh dear, we've been told that that's where B&Q are getting their wood from,
yep,
to go into this factory in Ho Chi Minh City. And I said, well, I don't think that's the case. Well, he said, you better go and have a look. And so I did. And what I found was that at Ma Da Forest Enterprise, nothing had changed since then. The trees had not suddenly got steroids and grown massively to be right, used for garden furniture. But there was a sawmill there, and the sawmill was bringing wood from Cambodia. Massive, great tropical hardwood logs.
Which is not what was being marketed.
And so B&Q had a nervous breakdown and said, this is no good. And because the army in Cambodia was doing the logging and they weren't doing it well. There was terrible environmental destruction, human rights abuses, and the remnants of the Khmer Rouge operations, yeah, through the timber industry. And so B&Q said, oh, we need to stop. And I said, hold on, you've got a factory in Ho Chi Minh City that's got 2,000 workers,
yeah,
and you're 80% of their business. If you stop your business, those people lose their jobs. So
yeah,
there are other forests in Vietnam where you can get your wood. So came this idea of like, well, let's dismantle the supply chain and build it up again.
Yeah.
Let's find a forest that's good and then go into that forest and give it technical assistance to the point where it could be certified. Longer process, but you're engaged where you're trying to make something better.
Yeah.
And they thought this was a good idea. And so we started looking for that forest, and that took a long time for various reasons. But basically what happened was in the summer of 1998, the European summer of 1998, the world's other NGOs, well, all the world's NGOs, got wind of what was happening in Cambodia, and that this massive explosion of wooden furniture imports into Vietnam was being fueled by the destruction of Cambodia's forests and human rights abuses for the people who lived in those places. Major campaign across the whole of Europe. Everyone went crazy. And what happened was, through word of mouth, everyone said, oh, to all the companies who were having a nervous breakdown, oh, you need to talk to Scott Poynton because he's trying to sort that out for B&Q. So all eyes came to me, and I was a consultant at the time.
Yeah.
And I said, well, yeah, this is what we're trying to do. We're trying to rebuild a supply chain. And the largest garden furniture company, Danish company called Scancom, contacted me and said, well, because they were being hit the hardest, as were their customers, because they're the biggest. And they said, well, we'd like to support this process.
Right.
One thing led to another. March 25th, 1999, the Tropical Forest Trust was born with this mission of effectively helping companies to be more responsible in their sourcing of raw materials. In this case, it was wood. And so TFT set about then trying to... We did transform the garden furniture industry, and then off we went, and we started working in the Congo Basin, where we got forest certified there. Sort of mediating conflicts between NGOs and companies was my specialty, I would say, and then in supporting the companies to keep the commitments. The NGOs were very strict, and they said, look, we want to see this sorted out. I would help the companies understand what needed to happen, and then we would help them do it.
Yep.
And the NGOs started to realise that this was working.
Yep.
And so, you know, there was this concern that we were taking money from the companies. But I always said to the NGOs, well, who else do you think should pay for this? Like, do you think we should be coming to get public money? These companies have been profiting from the sourcing of illegal timber forest destruction. I have a sense that they should pay to clean that up. We could go and compete for foundation money with you guys. Would you like that? No. How do we know you guys are going to be honest? I said, well, you can check. I will give you reports on what we're doing. You can come and visit us. You can see what we're doing. And ultimately, you know, as we bring the certified furniture to the market, you will see the transformation. I always said, you know, you can kick me to death if you want to. And the NGOs are very good at that. So my pledge to you is that I will be transparent, I will be honest, and if it's not working, I will stop.
Yep.
But we did it, and we did transform the garden furniture sector. We transformed the Congo Basin forest sector.
Yep.
Eventually it moved on to palm oil, pulp and paper. And, you know, as you mentioned at the start when we talked about this, you know, TFT. So the Tropical Forest Trust became the Forest Trust, which was still TFT because we were working in other countries beyond the tropics.
Yep.
And eventually it became Earthworm Foundation, which was also a link back to the St. Barb Baker Foundation story, because he did this wonderful... The thing that captured me in St. Barb's presentation was when he talked about planting trees in the Sahara and the Judean Hills, putting rocks beside trees that encourage the earthworms to come up and bring life, giving nutrients and water to those trees. And he said, you know, if a goat got in and knocked the rock away, the tree would die. And as a young 15-year-old, that hit me very hard. I'm like, wow, it's so tenuous, the life. You know, here's this community doing all this work to plant these trees. And if someone doesn't talk to the goat herder, it's all going to go to waste. And so for me, I very quickly learnt this, the goat herder was the most important person in this whole equation. But no one was talking to the goat herder. They were all yelling at the goat herder, get your goats out. And the goat herder was saying, you know, go, you know, rudely usually, you know, go to hell or something like this or worse. And so we had tension. We had tribal discussions and screaming at each other. And basically the environment suffered. So I learned from St. Barb's early words that if we're going to make progress, we need some earthworms in the equation, and we need rocks.
Hence the rebranding.
Hence the rebranding, yeah.
That's interesting. You know, and it says on the Earthworm website that you work in that difficult place between companies and NGOs to bring about transformation.
That's right.
So that's quite interesting. Do you feel that the dynamic between companies and NGOs is changing? It feels to me that sustainability, with my work in sustainability, which is all in the communication space, that it has evolved so much in the last decade that things may be changing now, but I'm not really sure. What do you think?
I have to tell you that I feel the NGOs have gone soft. I don't know what happened to Greenpeace, but I haven't seen them. Part of it was the world got sick of Greenpeace campaigns. But I have a very strong theory that people won't change unless they're uncomfortable. And Greenpeace, chief amongst the NGOs, were agents of discomfort. Like, if you've got Greenpeace hanging off your building, this is not good, because quickly that little video will go viral, and your brand will be mud.
Yeah.
And this is why they were very powerful. They were able to find out where environmental destruction was happening, make some funky social media, and it went viral. And this is what happened with Nestle in 2010. They made an extremely powerful 1 minute video that just blew Nestle out of the water. And Nestle were forced to confront this issue. It didn't go very well for a couple of months.
What was the issue?
So Nestle were using palm oil, allegedly from deforestation and the destruction of high conservation value forest, in their products. And this was That video launched on March 17th, 2010. And it had only been a few months earlier, November 2009, that the Nestle chairman had stood up in a public forum and said, we don't want any of our products to be linked to deforestation. And so a few months later, Greenpeace said, well, hello, this is what's going on. You are linked to deforestation. You are buying palm oil from this company, which is involved in this destruction. And they released a website where instead of Kit Kat, they had Killer.
Right.
And so Nestle went ballistic and said, well, you know, that's one of our trademarks, and we're going to sue you for trademark violation if you don't take it down. And so, of course, Greenpeace put that out and said, Nestle are going to sue us. And so it was the worst mistake possible. There's a whole business case studies now on this about how not to respond to campaigns. And Nestle is chief amongst them. And of course, it just went absolutely viral. And Nestle then tried to talk to Greenpeace, but it just went badly because Nestle went in with corporate presentations and look at all the good things we're doing, and we don't want to be linked to deforestation. And the Greenpeace guy sat there through the meeting saying, but you are. And here's this fellow, you know, fantastic guy, director of operations for Nestle called Jose Lopez, who's since passed away, sadly. But he was in this meeting, and the Nestle guys who were with him, like, he was close to God, Jose Lopez. And here's this Greenpeace guy saying, but you are linked to deforestation. But you are doing this bad thing. And it went badly. And two meetings, the same thing. They had no idea what to do. And so I heard about this and I contacted them. I said, I feel I might be able to help you. And I had some colleagues who worked there. And so I was, you know, went over there, and literally 2 weeks later, they announced the world's first no deforestation commitment, which I'd written for them. They signed off. We shared it with Greenpeace. They changed a few words here and there, and that changed everything.
That's interesting. So it was ultimately a kind of collaboration between Nestle and Greenpeace.
It was. But they needed a mediator.
Yeah.
And then the same thing happened then with the company Golden Agri Resources, which was the palm oil company that had been supplying Nestle with that oil. They were continued to be campaigned against, and we did exactly the same with them. Yeah. Negotiated and mediated between Greenpeace, and they came out in February 2011 with their no deforestation policy. Then their sister company, APP, who had been brutalised by NGOs for 20 years and effectively put the hand in the face of the NGOs and said, you know, go away, Greenpeace launched a major global campaign against them. And it took 2 years, but they eventually came out with their own commitment. And then the world's largest palm oil company, Wilmar, did the same. All of these processes were because NGOs, and in the Wilmar case, it was an NGO called, I'm embarrassed now, I can't remember the name, but they've since become led by a guy called Glenn Horowitz. They've become Mighty Earth. But they just put pressure on the NGOs. And so this is a long way of coming back to your original point. My concern with NGOs is we're just not seeing those campaigns, and it's almost like they've become too cozy with the businesses. That's not their job. Their job is to kick them hard and make them uncomfortable, and I'm just not seeing it. And I'm seeing lots of lovely sustainability meetings and all of this sort of stuff unfolding, and I'm like seeing the world go to hell. And I'm like, where are the people yelling about this? Where are the people who are hanging off buildings? Greenpeace are not doing it. WWF have never done it. You know, they're not true campaigning organisation. But I'm not seeing, there's not too many campaigning NGOs out there rattling cages, and we need it.
That's really interesting. So the NGOs are going soft, and yet on the other side, I know the latest corporate stuff, for example, with Nestle moving to kind of forest positive strategies, approaching zero deforestation across multiple key supply chains, and also looking very hard at regenerative agriculture, which seems to be the next big sustainability thing. So there seems to be a kind of strange vibe going on.
I agree, and I think Nestle are doing great things. I mean, they still get criticised, for example, for their bottled water and all the rest of it. I don't say they're perfect, But I look at the journey that Nestle's travelled with TFT, and they're still working with Earthworm, and they're walking the talk, is my sense. I mean, they're still doing it as a big corporate. At the end of the day, price is still important to them, and I do think that they could do things somewhat differently. But of these big corporates, I do believe Nestle are the leaders, is my sense, and they don't spend as much money on marketing and communications as some of their competitors like Unilever, who spend very large amounts of money telling the world how great they are. And a lot of people seem to believe that. I'm less believer in that. I think Unilever are doing some good things, but there's a lot more marketing to Unilever than there are to perhaps some of these other companies. But at the end of the day, still so much more needs to be done. And I think the NGOs are accelerators of change, and I'm just not seeing them around anymore. And maybe I'm missing it, but, you know, we don't just need activists, and this is a key thing. I hear a lot of people saying, if you want to change the world, be an activist. I'm like, well, hold on, we need mediators too.
Yeah.
And there's not a lot of mediators out there. There's no one stands in the middle ground, and this was always my role in TFT, was to stand in that middle place between the businesses and the NGOs, find a way forward, and then the TFT teams would come in and implement those agreements, help the companies go down that path.
Yeah.
And I think we need a lot more mediators, people who can help people cross thresholds and cross bridges. Because even if the NGOs aren't yelling, shareholders are, Gen Zers are. You know, the Gen Zers are calling for change. They're more a force for change now than I believe the NGOs are.
Yeah.
And these big corporates are looking at that saying, golly, you know, we've got to respond to that. We've got to walk the talk and show that we're doing things. And I think the Gen Z movement, the whole Gen Z, are a bigger force for change than NGOs like Greenpeace.
And what would be their mechanism for change? How would they?
Social media.
Social media.
You know, and social media. These kids live on social media, and they're very strong in sharing their opinions, and sharing what they like and don't like, and they want to see people taking action. So I think that the Nestlés of the world are seeing that, and they're responding to that. I think they can do more. I think they can go faster. But that's the mechanism for change these days, not the NGOs.
And it's interesting as well with you were saying about the, you know, a lot of the investors now. I mean, a lot of, I've had it commented a couple of times from major corporate clients who've said that they're getting tougher questions from their shareholders and from their investors.
That's right.
On their sustainability activities than they are from NGOs.
Correct.
More informed, more precise, drilling down more. So that's a turn up for the books. I don't think I'd have imagined that even a decade ago.
No, me neither. And it's a pleasure to see it. It's great to see it. And I think that is adding its own pressure. And part of that is because Gen Zers on social media are naming and shaming the investors. And the investors don't want that.
No.
Right. And they realize, but also there's another aspect of that is, you know, now that there's a decade or more of track record on this, they're looking at the numbers, and the companies that committed early and positively and strongly and actually did some of these sustainability things have shown repeatedly to be the ones that make the best returns.
Yeah.
So even if the investors don't, and I'm not convinced that so many of them truly care about the planet, to be honest with you. Maybe I'm just become too cynical, but there's a lot of talk out there about impact investors, but when it comes down to it, they want their 20% rate of return.
Mm.
But I think even if they're not so worried about the Gen Zers giving them trouble or all of these things, they're starting to realise that it's the companies that operate in a more sustainable, you know, responsible way that give the best returns. This is great. You know, so I don't care why they do it. You know, I don't mind if they're just cynical about it. But, like, invest your money in businesses that are doing good things. Please do that. And then, you know, we'll see things moving in the right direction.
Yeah, that's great. And what do you think, as individuals, we can do? If, you know, I often feel quite disempowered, and I'm quite lucky. A lot of my work is around sustainability communication, so I get to talk about the great work that other people are doing. Mm. But what is it that individuals can do? Is it, I mean, does things like One Tree Planted, is that helpful? Is it better to volunteer locally? What should people be doing?
Yeah, look, there's many things you can do, and there's no silver bullet to any of these things. And I think first and foremost is to just look at your own life. Like, before you go out and, yeah, I mean, One Tree Planted and all, that's fine. They're doing good work. But before you go and do that, like, what's happening in your life? Have you got a lot of food waste, for example? Like, you know, what are you doing on your carbon emissions? Because all of these things count for nothing. Of course we need people to invest money in biodiversity conservation. Of course we need to do things like tree planting and things like this. But if we don't get... I mean, the reason I left TFT was because it was very clear to me. At one stage, a few years after we'd set up all these no deforestation commitments, there was a study done. Climate Advisors was the other NGO that really led the work on Wilmar. They did a study that identified, as a result of the no deforestation commitments that Wilmar, Golden Agri Resources and other palm oil companies in particular had made, 6 million hectares of forest had been set aside in Indonesia alone. Right? That's amazing. And it was very quickly, very quick. It wasn't, you know, a decade later. It was like 2 or 3 years later, because the palm oil companies realised that if they chopped that down, that forest in their concessions, and that was spread over many, many concessions, that they wouldn't be able to sell their palm oil into Western markets. So those no deforestation commitments had a huge impact. But what I realised is we were helping set aside forests from bulldozers, but they were just going to burn down if we didn't get our arms around climate change.
Yeah.
As we're seeing now, you know, the forests are going up in smoke. It's not rocket science, particularly being a forester, to understand that if the temperatures go up and the rainfall goes down, forests are going to dry out and make them more prone to wildfires. But that's what's happening. And I was actually, the pivotal moment for me, you know, like with St. Barbara Baker, I was in the back of a taxi in March 2014. Wilmar, the world's largest palm oil company, had just made its announcement in December 2013, and a journalist from Australia who was working in Indonesia said, I'd like to talk to you about how a young bloke from the bush is in this position of helping these companies cross these thresholds. His father had been my professor at ANU Forestry, lovely guy called Michael Batchelard, and we were going off to his place for dinner and for an interview, and we were stuck for about 3 hours in the back of a taxi in Jakarta. And so he said to me, he said, do you think these commitments, we got started in our discussions, and he said, do you think these commitments are going to make a difference? And I said, look, I think short term they will, because I was in the boardrooms. I could see the leaders of these companies making dramatic purchasing decisions and putting on, you know, instead of having one person on their sustainability team, they then had 100. They were going for it. But I said to Michael then, I said, you know, short term, great, but medium to long term, we're in trouble. Because even if we set the forest aside, they will burn, or they'll be attacked by pests and diseases, and then they'll burn. And over the last few years, exactly what we've seen happening. Mm. And we're seeing it now. And so that's why, you know, then I was in TFT and I'm like, well, I need to focus on that. All of the experience I had in the dark rooms, as I call it, with the leaders of these companies. Because, you know, all my work was, and another reason why Earthworm changed its name to Earthworm is because, you know, earthworms work below the surface, right? Yeah. And all my work was in the dark room. Like you heard about the announcement of the work, but you never saw the work.
Yeah.
The work to support the leader of the company and the NGOs to talk together to find a mediated solution. That was all in a dark room. And I realized that the experience I had doing that could just as be easily oriented around helping get companies to commit proper and real and strong action to climate change, as it was to working on no deforestation, human rights issues. And up until that point, and even today, commitments were pretty weak. Oh, we'll reduce our emissions a little bit and then we'll offset the rest. So let's not get into the whole discussion around that, but that's just greenwashing nonsense. And so my idea was to set up a program to do something about that. And I realised that I had to leave TFT to do that. And so that was the real reason why I stepped aside, and now I've set up the Pond Foundation, because and people say, oh, you're not working on forests anymore. I'm like, yes, I am. I'm not, you know, TFT, now Earthworm, are still working to protect forests. There's other NGOs doing that. But, you know, we need those people to work on keeping them standing.
Yeah.
My job is to help grapple with climate change so they don't burn down. And so that's why I left TFT. And, I'd had enough of that work anyway. I was burnt out. It was time for change. But that was the essential reason. And step by step, you know, we're seeing some companies coming into this place, and I'm challenging people myself now to say, look, you know, just your offsetting malarkey isn't going to make it. You need to take stronger action. So this is a long way of coming back to your question. What can you do? Look at your own carbon footprint, because all of the other things we're doing, you know, you can plant trees, which is great, and we should plant trees, but if we don't deal with climate change, they're just going to die.
Yeah.
Because it's just going to get too hot for them. Right? So what's your carbon footprint? What's your food waste? How much energy do you use in your house? All of these things you can be measured, and you can work them out, and then you can start taking action. Eat less meat, for example. This has a huge impact on reducing carbon footprints. And then workouts of what we've done with the Pond Foundation is help people say, this is my lifetime carbon, not just this year's, this is how much carbon I've emitted over the course of my life. Now I'm going to invest in tree planting or in soil carbon projects or blue carbon projects, and I'm going to support projects that are going to take that carbon out of the atmosphere. So by the time I check out of here, I'm carbon zero. I haven't contributed any carbon into the atmosphere. Imagine if we could get millions of people doing that.
And
it's not just individuals we need to do it, we need companies to do it, because they are the major polluters. And so that's what we're doing at the Pond Foundation. So encouraging individuals and companies to take real action. Say, like, let's reduce our emissions. Yes, let's remove carbon from the atmosphere so that we're not contributing to climate change. And forget about offsetting nonsense. And then inspire other people to do it. Get on your communications and inspire other people to do it. So, yeah, just look at home and then look at what you can do outside with one tree planting and things like that.
Great. That's really awesome. That's a really, really interesting way to wrap as well. So I'll put links to the Pond Foundation
The
show notes so people can learn more there as well. But thank you very much for your time. It's been a broad, very, very broad discussion covering a lot of areas. Where can people find out more about you if they want to know more?
Yeah, well, so there's LinkedIn, of course, but my company is called A Different Way. So I have two organisations now since I left TFT. One's just a company, A Different Way. So Google adifferentway.life, that's the website, and then the Pond Foundation. And I tend not to be a raucous communicator in terms of, you know, putting things out there. I'm an earthworm, you know. So I don't go out there saying, oh, you know, here, come and work with me, I'm a hero. It's not my way, but I like to blog, I like to challenge people. I write, I'm pretty provocative in some of my comments, and so if people are interested to learn more about that, find me on LinkedIn, adifferentway.life, or thepondfoundation.org. Thanks so much anyway for your interest also, Fergus, in talking to me.
Oh, you're very welcome. It was a fantastic discussion.
Thanks, mate.
Thank you. That's it for this episode. Thanks very much to Scott Poynton for his time. In the next episode, we'll be talking to technical writer Ruan McFadden on how he resurrected an extinct Irish sport through the power of storytelling. He'll also be talking us through his approach to writing his fantastic podcast series, The Hero with a Thousand Holes. So if you're interested in sports or Irish culture, be sure to check that out. Until next time, I'm Fergus Dullahan, and this is the Copywriters Podcast.